Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Your lawyer is 10, 15, 20 miles away in a courtroom, someone you've never met, who now you just see on a television screen. This is not ideal way of communicating with anyone.
Not everyone is happy about the new move to digitize British courts and legal documents. Hello, and welcome to Spectrum. I'm Cyrus Farivar in Bonn, Germany, with what's new in the world of European science and technology news. Also coming up, Basque and American engineers work together to build a foldable electric car.
It is European social innovation at its best. It is a successful example of how to give a new lease of life to traditional industrial sectors by contributing to address major modern societal challenges.
And an auto industry analyst takes us through some of the hurdles of selling mini cars like this one. All that and more this week on Spectrum. In my home country of the United States, there is a culture of people cutting coupons to save money. In the old days, you would grab a newspaper, cut out the coupon, bring it to the store, and save 50 cents on coffee or whatever. These days, though, a lot of coupons have moved online. They've even taken new forms, like bringing a massive short-term deal to a bunch of people at once. Chicago startup Groupon has made a name for itself worldwide by offering limited-time, deeply discounted deals as a way to get new customers in the door. But some companies have now made the leap to smartphones. Earlier this month in Germany, Groupon and Deutsche Telekom, Germany's telecom giant, announced that they would be working together. While both companies are reluctant to offer up details for now, other German startups may point toward mobile commerce yet to come. Cinnamon Nippard has more from Berlin.
I'm standing with Philipp von Röder from Dealomeo on the street in Berlin's Mitte district. It's just after 11 a.m. and he's opened the Dealomeo app on his iPhone to check out the deals on offer. You can choose deals by how close they are to you or by time, as in how long the offer is valid for.
So if I go by distance and I'm hungry right now, so it's time for a late breakfast, and I would find this, it's a reichhaltiges Frühstück, so it's a big breakfast costing €7.20. And then I hit the button, I want that, will ich, and the deal is valid for another hour and 41 minutes.
But when he presses the I want that button on his screen, he's not actually spending any money. Von Röder just has to go to the cafe and tell them he'd like to take advantage of the breakfast offer. So the big difference between Dealomeo's setup and the new Groupon telecom arrangement is that with Groupon, the user actually has to buy the voucher first in order to get the deal.
You have to actually pay before you go to the store for that voucher, and then you can redeem the voucher.
Florian Rizach is the CEO of Dealomeo, which launched in September 2011.
This is quite popular in the US, and we see a lot of traction in Japan and in Asian markets for that kind of apps. In Germany, I think geolocated e-commerce is just about to come in the next year.
Research says that it's still not so convenient for people to pay for things using their mobile phones. Some companies are working on wireless digital wallet options, which would allow customers to preload their phones with credit. But all the e-commerce players, including companies like Dealomeo, are hoping to make it even easier to spend money.
This will also change in the future, and if telecom is actually a way of making people pay with their mobile contract and their phone number, then it's a very easy approach.
Theoretically, it's a win-win for everyone. Businesses get new customers and customers save money. Groupon gets access to millions of customers through Deutsche Telekom. The Financial Times Deutschland newspaper estimated that telecom will take in 2 to 3 billion euros in revenue by 2015. Priscilla Tomasoa is a spokesperson for Deutsche Telekom. She says the company will roll out services in several European countries in the first half of this year.
We could offer the Groupon app on our handsets that customers get from us, so that it's not necessary for customers to download the app, but it's more convenient to have it on your phone already.
But whether customers choose to use the app is still up to them. After all, Germany is a country that's pretty worried about privacy and data protection.
Deutsche Telekom customers always have a choice to either use the services or not, so it's obviously opt-in. We won't push anything to customers that they don't want to.
Still, Deutsche Telekom is being pretty cagey about some of the details of the deal. They won't say yet where it will be available, which cities, which retailers, which phones, and who is paying who. But this geolocated, mobile-driven commerce is still largely uncharted territory. Martin Gill is an e-business analyst at Forrester Research. He said that while he hasn't seen this kind of partnership before, it actually makes total sense.
I think it's quite a smart partnership in terms of it allows Groupon to kind of gain access to these kind of services without having to develop or deploy the technology themselves.
Currently, no company is offering Europe-wide services, but within each country, there are myriad daily deals, offers and voucher sites. If Telekom is successful, it's not hard to imagine that it could roll out this type of system to other countries where it operates, including Hungary, Macedonia and the Netherlands. But cracking the German market is going to be hard enough. Gill, the Forrester analyst, says that patterns of usage varies widely across Europe. For example, he says in Scandinavia and Italy, people are more likely to use their phones for a range of different applications. But that's not the typical case in Germany.
When it comes to using their phones, German shoppers or German consumers really think of their phones as things to talk on. But they're not that interested in using the mobile internet or using kind of other services.
Surprisingly, German smartphone usage is below many other countries. It's hard to know why. It could be because Germans can be conservative when it comes to switching devices or an ageing population. Again, Florian Riesach of Delomeo.
Especially in terms of smartphone usage, for example, the German market is behind Poland and Spain, for example, and way behind the UK.
Still, whoever can get Germans to buy more smartphones and spend money on them will have the largest national market within Europe at their fingertips. Now, where's that sushi Groupon I printed out? Cinema Nippard, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
And now, it's time for Digital Europe.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
While the arrival of the digital age has transformed almost every industry around the world, in the UK there's one profession where paper is still king, the law. Lawyers carry around piles of legal documents, and judges sift through lever arch files of photocopied evidence painstakingly compiled by legal staff and police. The government believes it's time to change all that and make criminal justice in the UK digital, saving 60 million euros in the process. Some officials have called it the biggest transformational change in a generation. But recently, the government's plans have been challenged by law firms worried that they could unfairly favor the prosecution and make justice in the UK less fair. Robin Powell reports from London.
It's easy to spot a criminal trial lawyer on the streets of London. He or she will be wearing a smart, dark suit, walking at pace to their next court appearance, and almost always wheeling behind them a black, medium-sized trolley bag. The bag's for legal papers, and lots of them. Tom Baker's been a criminal barrister for 7 years. So, Tom, what's in the bag?
Well, on top, there's the Archbold, which is a very heavy, 4-inch thick practitioner's text, which I carry with me everywhere. Underneath that, there is my papers for tomorrow, which is about a sort of 3-inch thick stack tied up with a bit of pink ribbon. That signifies that this is a defence brief. If it was a prosecution brief, it would have white ribbon tied around it.
The UK government's criminal prosecuting authority, the Crown Prosecution Service, or CPS, prints around 300 million sheets of paper per year. In a speech last September, the Criminal Justice Minister, Nick Herbert, announced an end to the paper mountain.
First, we must bring justice into the 21st century. So by next April, we're requiring the entire criminal justice system to go digital, with secure electronic transfer of case files between the police, prosecutors and courts, and a reduction in the number of times that the same information has to be captured or compiled.
Well, as that April deadline approaches, the CPS can point to numerous milestones, including the first paperless prosecution in June last year at a court in southern England. But defence firms are up in arms. In a letter to the Director of Public Prosecutions in December, the 30 largest criminal defence firms wrote that the costs of going digital could, in these difficult economic times, push some defence firms into bankruptcy. Those costs include initial outlays for upgrading hardware and software, but also the cost of using the secure email system that Herbert mentioned in his speech. Until now, defence firms have generally received one or two hard copies of the case bundle from CPS. Defence lawyer Richard Atkinson, who also chairs the British Law Society's Criminal Law Committee, explains that if the bundle is transferred by email, the higher security level means he can't simply forward those emails onto his clients, not to mention the fact that those clients may be in custody and not have access to email.
If they want a copy of their papers, which many do, of course, then I will have to print them out. And what you therefore see is that the system that was developed to save the Crown Prosecution Service printing out lots of paper results in defence firms printing out lots of paper. And the system that was aimed at saving costs for the Crown Prosecution Service now creates costs for the defence.
The head of the efficiency programme at the CPS, Ben Widdicombe, replies that digitisation will actually cost less for defence firms in the longer term. It's more than just saving on printing.
They, I think, only would have to look to the savings they would make in, say, courier costs, because they don't have to send the big case files on, often many, many boxes. Equally, they don't have to pay for storage or archiving costs.
Another innovation is the use of so-called virtual courts. While the use of live video links for police and witnesses is already widespread, virtual courts where defendants, judges or lawyers appear in court via video link are only being tested in two sites in and just outside London. The CPS says virtual courts have already saved over 100 hours of police time. But Atkinson challenges the CPS to see it from the point of view of the accused.
Your lawyer is 10, 15, 20 miles away in a courtroom, someone you've never met, who now you just see on a television screen. This is not ideal way of communicating with anyone. But trying to communicate with someone whose very liberty depends upon those communications is a very doubtful way of proceeding in a judicial capacity.
If the pilots are successful and new legislation allows, virtual courts are set to be held in other parts of the country as well. Another way, say the CPS, that the UK is pioneering the integration of technology and the law. But most legal professionals express scepticism that the infrastructure of the justice system here can cope with digital lawyering. Court buildings often don't have Wi-Fi, nor adequate power sockets. Plus, many prisons don't even allow lawyers to take in their own laptops. Indeed, the CPS now talks about going primarily, rather than entirely, digital by April. Robin Powell for Deutsche Welle Radio, London.
If you like, you can download Digital Europe as a separate podcast. Just search for DW Digital Europe in iTunes. Coming up, how a Basque electric car hopes to change urban mobility. But first, here's Shant Shurigyan with the news.
Tougher rules on data protection are coming to the European Union with far-reaching implications for web giants like Google and Facebook. Last Wednesday, the European Commission proposed sweeping changes to its 1995 Data Protection Directive, including the right to be forgotten and 24-hour breach notification. The proposed legislation, which consists of both new rules and clarification of existing ones, comes amid big changes in how people use the internet. Hundreds of millions of people are now subscribed to social networks like Facebook and LinkedIn, as well as to cloud computing services, which store data on servers outside of the 27-nation bloc. Hot off the heels of the recent online blackout day to protest pending anti-piracy bills in the American House of Representatives and Senate, massive protests were held in Poland last week to protest a similar bill. The Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, or ACTA, was signed by Poland and a number of other EU member states this month. The treaty is an agreement between the EU and a number of other countries around the world, including the US, Canada, Australia, and Singapore, over issues of intellectual property violations and piracy for both digital and physical goods. Critics say that the agreement goes too far and could have negative effects for freedom of expression and privacy online. While planet-destroying asteroids hitting the Earth have so far remained firmly in the realm of science fiction, space agencies are now collaborating to study techniques for deflecting near-Earth objects. Last week, the Neo Shield project launched in Berlin. The group consists of representatives from the European Space Agency, NASA, and Roscosmos, the Russian space agency. They are tasked with figuring out the best ways to deflect or explode massive asteroids. The European Union has committed 4 million euros to the project. An Iranian woman who won a 2005 blogging prize from Deutsche Welle was arrested earlier this month in Iran as part of a recent crackdown against journalists and online activists. Parastu Dukahaki became known for being one of Iran's earliest female bloggers, and her site, Zan Nevesht, or Woman Writer, often took on women's issues, although she has not worked as a journalist in recent years. Iran's Supreme Court has also confirmed last year's death sentence of Saeed Malakpour, an Iranian-Canadian web developer who has been held since 2008. Earlier this month, Iran's intelligence minister said the arrested bloggers and writers had, quote, envisioned carrying out American plans to disrupt the parliamentary elections by using cyberspace and social networks, unquote. And finally today, watch out who you CC your emails to at your office. Last week, the German parliament's email system was crippled for several hours when hundreds of people responded to an email that one person had accidentally sent to over 4,000 coworkers. According to the Reuters news agency, the flood of emails began when one woman accidentally replied to all on the Bundestag email list with a short message to a colleague. As many people responded back, and the errant message ended up having the effect of delaying delivery of some internal mails by up to 30 minutes.
Shant Sharigyan with the news there. You're listening to Spectrum on Deutsche Welle Radio. I'm Sarus Farivar. Now, if you're like me and you're never near your actual radio, feel free to download Spectrum as a podcast. Take us with you on your commute or listen at your computer whenever you like. Every day when I bike to work, I always have my favorite podcasts in my earbuds. It's a great way to keep up to date with what's going on. And I have to apologize, these past couple of weeks we've had some problems with our podcast feed. If you would still like to listen to Spectrum online, you can do so at dw-world.de/spectrum. Beyond that, come and interact with us. See what I'm reading and get a taste of what we're working on between shows on Twitter at dw_SciTech. That's also where we'll have the latest status updates for the Spectrum podcast. Last week, a transatlantic team of designers and builders unveiled a new kind of electric car that is designed not only to save gas, but to save physical space as well. Meet Hiriko, a new foldable electric car. It was designed at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in the U.S., but built in Spain's Basque Country in the north part of the region. Terry Schultz attended its debut at the European Union headquarters in Brussels just last week.
Hiriko's designers would like nothing more than to see their prized product collapse on streets all over the world. That's right, one of the Hiriko electric car's big selling points is that it folds up, kind of like a baby stroller, and takes only about a third of the parking area of a smart car. That's important in crowded European city centers, like the mishmash of one-way streets and construction zones around European Commission headquarters, where Hiriko was launched on Tuesday. To the energetic beat of Basque music in honor of the car's birthplace in rural Spain, European Commission President José Manuel Barroso climbed into the first-ever model of the two-seater. Positioning himself behind the touchscreen-like steering wheel, he gave it a big thumbs up. MIT PhD candidate Will Lark admires the little car on stage like a proud father. As one of the lead designers, Lark has spent 7 years working on the project, which he says started when an advisor in the MIT Media Lab told students they actually should reinvent the wheel. So they did. That's how the car can be less than 2 meters long. The engine is split up and contained in the wheels, so it has four-wheel steering and four-wheel drive, powered by two lithium-ion batteries. Lark says it's very practical for repairs. Engine trouble? Pop off the problematic wheel and replace it. Lark is confident that though many models of plug-in cars have come and gone without electrifying the market, Hiriko is finally the one that will take off.
It combines a number of unique technologies in a way that a lot of other cars do not. Would you tend to find with a lot of alternative cars that they make small incremental changes to already existing chassis? And what we've done here is really redefine what the vehicle is.
Commission President Barroso says the HIRICO project is redefining more than just a vehicle.
It is European social innovation at its best. Firstly, it is a successful example of how to give a new lease of life to traditional industrial sectors by contributing to address major modern societal challenges, in that specific case, urban mobility and pollution.
And it wasn't big industry that took the lead. It was seven small companies in Vitoria, Spain, that decided they would bring the MIT concept to life. Vitoria Mayor Javier Maroto isn't shy about saying his city should be seen as a model, too.
The whole European society should think in green, should think green. I mean, should think sustainability is an opportunity, environmental issues is an opportunity, recycling, water quality, all these things are an opportunity, because it's not only saving carbon dioxide, it's saving money as well. It's an opportunity of creating a new society.
The first cars off the Vitoria production line are expected to cost a bit over 12,000 euros each to manufacture. They'll be tested in car share programs that work like the bike share concept. Cities expressing interest in being the first include Malmö, Sweden, Barcelona, and Berlin. Even with eager testers, it's still going to be a rough road for HIRICO, says auto industry analyst Tim Urquhart with IHS Global Insights. He points to the experience of the smart car.
Smart's an established concept, and it's backed by a company like Daimler, and even that struggled. So it's you know, again, for any new entrant into this market, a startup with no track record of experience in the automotive industry, it's going to be difficult. But again, you have to sort of take your hat off to these guys, you know, for the innovation involved.
Terry Schultz, Deutsche Welle Radio, Brussels.
And finally today, let's continue our conversation about this new HIRICO car. In that piece that you just heard, there was an auto analyst, Tim Urquhart, with IHS Global Insight. He and I had a much longer conversation about how tough it will be for the folks behind HIRICO to actually get these cars on the road. He told me that sales of these types of city cars have stagnated within the last year. In 2010, global sales of what are called A-segment cars hit 6.2 million units. That dropped a little to 5.9 million in 2011, but they're expected to pick back up again this year. Some people may remember the Smart Car, a zippy little car that debuted in Europe back in 1994, which was backed by Germany's Daimler and Swatch, the Swiss watchmaker. But even that car has only sold under a million units worldwide over the last decade. In other words, HIRICO has a long way to go. I have here in front of me photos of this HIRICO car that was unveiled just this past week in Brussels. And I was wondering if you could just start off by telling me your impressions of this car.
Well, it certainly appears very innovative. Sort of the way the car sort of swivels to make the wheelbase shorter so it can fit into smaller parking spaces is certainly a very, very novel idea. Whether, you know, by saving maybe half a meter or a meter or whatever it is on, you know, in terms of a car the size of a Smart, which would be its sort of natural rival, is really going to sort of, you know, get it a niche in the market. I don't know really. It's a very ambitious project. There's a lot of, you know, distinct engineering challenges in there, especially the hinged sort of chassis concept to make it smaller to park it. And also on top of that, you've got the whole sort of electric vehicle drivetrain as well to sort of fit into to package into that sort of very innovative sort of chassis concept as well. So it's a it's certainly an engineering challenge. There's no doubt about that.
Now, I understand that they're going to be pricing this car at about 12,500 euros. Do you think the market will respond to a car at that price?
I think it's a challenge. I mean, you know, I admire anyone who's starting up one of these electric vehicle concepts at the moment. You know, there are lots of sort of these startup companies out there coming out with these electric vehicles with concepts that are, you know, at either spectrum of the at each end of the spectrum of being very innovative or quite conventional cars. I think that's quite a high price point for something that, you know, is from an unproven company and is an unproven concept. But you know, there's a lot of technology and R&D that goes into these EVs, and especially with this one in particular, with the novel sort of hinged chassis concept. So, If they can sell it for that, it might find a market. But I'd be just a little bit sort of wary, as if they could actually sell it at that price and still make a margin on the vehicle. Because as I say, there's a lot of technology and a lot of engineering R&D that needs to go into this vehicle to make it work.
Now, one of the features of this car are that the four wheels can turn 90 degrees so that the car effectively can parallel park sideways, from what I understand. Is that correct?
As far as I understand as well, yes. That's what I've seen. I've seen the video where the car basically turns on its own axis, which obviously gives it, you know, a big advantage in terms of sort of city driving and city parking and getting into sort of small, difficult parking spaces. And again, it's a great concept, it's a great idea. My only sort of concern would be that you're already, you know, most manufacturers are just starting out with just doing an electric vehicle. You know, you've got manufacturers like Renault who are investing billions of euros in engineering sort of, you know, very good, very sturdy electric vehicles that will do the job properly. They're not trying to overcomplicate things by doing an EV and then putting in all this sort of high technology stuff like the steering system on this car. And also, again, the hinge or the concept which makes the car shorter, which means it will fit into a shorter parking space. Again, there's a heck of a lot of stuff going on with this particular vehicle. You know, I admire the innovation involved. I admire the sort of the ambition of the project. But, you know, they're going to have to really, really sort of get this thing right and get the engineering right to make it all work properly. So it's a decent proposition for the consumer at the end of the line. So, you know, if they can make it all work, fantastic. But I'd be a little bit skeptical, you know, if the early vehicles will be without any issues. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. How have cars that are designed for small spaces, for particularly small European streets, I'm thinking in particular of the Smart Car, I don't know if there are other models that kind of fit in that subcategory, how have they done in recent years?
Well, I mean, the Smart project has never really sort of taken off as much as I'm sure Daimler would have wanted it to. I mean, it sort of found a niche and it's got a loyal following, but it's never really sort of gained the kind of market traction that I'm sure Daimler forecast for it. But part of this problem with Smart has been the fact that it really is only a single car model range, and it was, I think, originally designed to be a two or three car model range. They are working with Renault at the moment to develop a new range of cars, which will include another vehicle to go with the 4.2 model, which is the model that everyone knows, a bigger four-door model. Smart's an established concept, and it's backed by a company like Daimler, and even that struggled. So it's you know, again, for any new entrant into this market, a startup with no track record of experience in the automotive industry, it's going to be difficult. But again, you have to sort of take your hat off to these guys, you know, for the innovation involved. Obviously, the MIT is involved, the American MIT, so in terms of the engineering design of the vehicle. So that has to be a tick in their favor. It has the backing of the Spanish government. But at the same time, it's going to be a very difficult and long, hard road, I think, for these guys. But, you know, as I say, you've got to admire their ambition.
Tim Urquhart, thank you very much for your time today.
No problem, Cyrus. Anytime.
Tim Urquhart is an auto industry analyst with IHS Global Insight in London. That's all for this week on Spectrum. Want to learn more about something you heard in the show? Send us a message on Twitter at @DW_SciTech. In between episodes, you can always find daily news updates at dw-world.de/science. Email us your questions and comments to feedback.english@dw-world.de. Also, please be sure to put Spectrum in the subject line. From Deutsche Welle Radio in Bonn, Germany, I'm Cyrus Farivar, and thanks for listening. Time that her memories will fade, cause he's racing and pacing and parting the course. He's fighting and fighting and riding on his horse. The sun has gone down and the moon is coming.